This is Tell Me More, the Sunday magazine on 101.1 More FM, WBEB Philadelphia. I'm Emily Scheibert. Good morning. This week, dating violence. In 2005, Bill and Michelle Mitchell lost their only daughter, Kristen, then 21, when her boyfriend stabbed her in a fit of rage 3 weeks after graduating from St. Joe's University in Philadelphia. Dating abuse is defined as physical, sexual, or psychological violence within a close relationship. It isn't an argument every once in a while or a bad mood after a bad day. Dating violence is a pattern of controlling behavior that someone uses against a girlfriend or boyfriend. In addition to the risk of injury or death, victims of dating violence are more likely to engage in risky sexual behavior, eating disorders, substance use, and suicide attempts. And it's not uncommon. 40% of girls age 14 to 17 report knowing someone their age who's been hit or beaten by a boyfriend. Domestic violence doesn't have a face or an age, according to Bill Mitchell. It can happen to anybody. Since Kristen's death, Bill and the Kristen Mitchell Foundation have supported educational efforts to raise awareness about the dangers of abusive dating relationships. Something very tragic happened to your family. It's probably the worst thing a parent can imagine happening to a child. Were there any inklings, were there any signs that were evident to you that perhaps your daughter's relationship was violent?
Well, a couple of things. It's very common, even if someone does get killed, it's very common that the relationship is actually not violent until the last part. So my daughter was not in a violent relationship as best as anybody, including her friends, could tell. So I really don't think she was, and I don't think she would have stayed in a violent relationship. I think she was flat out scared of violent behavior out of people. So she would never have stayed in that relationship, and then there are times where I wish he had hit her at some point. Maybe she would have left him, and then we wouldn't have to do what we have to do now. But from our standpoint, my wife and I, my son, at the time that this happened, we live outside of Baltimore, and Kristen was at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia. So we were in constant touch with her, but on the other hand, it wasn't like we saw her, very, very often. We weren't there. We weren't having long discussions with her, which is a shame because we may have discovered more about her relationship with her boyfriend. But this guy came along, and she dated him for really only 4 months. And she graduated on May 14th of 2005. And, of course, our family went up and we were there for the graduation. And that was the day that we met her boyfriend, right after the graduation took place in this large white tent, 800 people. That actually, for me and for my son, that was actually the first time we met him. And that was actually the last day we saw her alive.
Wow.
So that was a weird handoff, the way that kind of worked. The kind of beginning of him and the end of her. But the only thing that was any hint that things may not be great was only in a phone conversation my wife had with my daughter when my daughter was talking a little bit about her boyfriend, and my wife said, well, what's it like? What's this guy like and all? She said, well, it's not the perfect relationship. But that was really it. My wife did not know in those days to pursue that, not that she wasn't completely interested in my daughter and my son and me. And of course, if I heard something like that today from some teenager or somebody in their at any age, really, and they said, well, it's not really the perfect relationship, I would immediately say, well, okay, so what would be the perfect relationship, and how would you characterize your relationship? I would just keep asking good questions. But back in those days, I probably would have heard it, and I probably would have thought, like my wife did, that this is a relationship that's probably not going to last very long, and then she'll just move on to somebody else who will be the next boyfriend or maybe more. But that was the only hint. I can tell you in the meantime that my daughter's friends, on the other hand, saw him quite a lot, really did not like him that much, were bothered by him. They would have characterized him in those days as being manipulative and kind of controlling about everything that was going on, always wanting everything to kind of go his way. these are the kind of warning signs that if you know better, you say, well, wait a minute, this could be drifting into a trouble area here. But that's what he was all about. He was always texting her and sending her emails and just always constantly checking up on her. I mean, just really over the top. I mean, anybody can check up on anybody. But, you know, you don't do it multiple times every hour. Like, well, what are you doing now? Well, when will you be home? Well, why is this taking so long? You know, these kinds of things, which is what he was famous for. So I think to most people up there, it was an annoyance. To her friends, it was an annoyance. And to Kristen, it was an annoyance. But on the other hand, nobody thought, wow, if this gets out of hand, this guy could kill somebody. Two of her closest friends who went on to make, who created the foundation, actually said, why don't you just get some space from this guy for a while? In fact, her closest friend, Samantha, said, why don't you just get some space? I mean, if you're really meant to be, why don't you take a few days off? And Kristen would never get to that place except in the last 24 hours. And she actually sent an email to me when, for the very first time, the night before she was killed, she actually owned up to the fact that this was not a great relationship and they'd had a fight that afternoon, which I know from people who were around it was just this verbal go back and forth thing. One of her comments in her email was, I have to get some space so I can be myself for a while. I'm getting suffocated by this guy. It looks like she sent that email to me and she was probably attacked and killed by him about an hour to an hour and a half after that. So that was in the early hours of June 3rd, which is a Friday of 2005.
And then you get a phone call.
So, the phone rang and it was a detective saying, I need to meet with you. I need to tell you something. Said that they had already been to her house. Nobody was there, which was true. And said, I need to tell you something. And I said, well, what do you need to tell me? And they said, well, we can't do this over the phone. Anyway, so I wound up picking a supermarket near where I live. So that's when, they pulled up in their cars and got out. And I said, well, if you got to tell me something, just tell me right here. So they told me by the automatic doors of the grocery store, basically, that your daughter died today. She was murdered by her boyfriend. So that's how I got it.
And your whole life changes in a moment.
Yeah, your whole life changes in one sentence. And I realized it. I totally understood it. I got it. And my mind leapt to all the things I'd been looking forward to with regards to her and our family that had no chance of happening. I mean, I kind of ticked off the obvious holidays and birthdays and potential weddings one day to somebody. And I wasn't acting out a part. I was just going with what I was thinking. And most of it was, how am I going to tell my family? And I felt like I'd been somehow, by God or somehow, picked as the messenger of the worst possible news probably in our lives.
Do you think it was kinder hearing the news from you, less frightening? I mean, there's no way around the awfulness of it.
Yeah, I do. I think that was the easiest way for it to happen. And I just went on to say, I don't know how this ever happened, but evidently Kristen's boyfriend killed her today. She stabbed her to death. And that's why the police wanted to meet with me. And that's what we got. And, you know, we need to pull together and figure out what the steps are from this point. But that's it. You know, that's why you're here. That's why I'm talking to you.
There's such a cruelty about it. Because your daughter was so beautiful. She had just graduated from college, you know, that sort of beautiful moment when you've launched a young adult into the world and the expectations and hopes, and she's just starting out. And to have that snuffed out so cruelly and violently must have been such a blow for you and your family.
In every last facet of your life, I mean, it's anxiety-inducing for anybody. I used probably the word suffocating earlier, but it is suffocating in its own way because there's a problem that you can't solve. And none of us in the room talking about it that evening, there's nothing anybody's going to do. You're not going to fix this. I mean, you can't help but want all the details, even though you know it adds up to someone's dead, but you want to, you can't help but wonder why. I mean, even now I wonder why to a great degree, even though I have a better understanding, but the other part of it is you have a lot of jobs. So the next morning, I mean, literally, you get up, take a shower, and you're in the car, and now you're going to funeral homes and interviewing them and thinking, okay, should we do it here? And then your cell phone's going off, and it's the detectives with just talking to you about some details, and then it's the apartment complex calling you, which is, you know, she had an apartment in this apartment complex, and they're calling up, and they were not pushy about when are you going to get your things out of here, but they were just giving us different bits and pieces and updates, and then, of course, family members calling from all angles and everything. So, but we were on quite a treadmill there, really the first, I'd say, 10 days after this happened.
Speak, if you would, about the experience of going through the criminal justice system with this case. What was your takeaway from that?
Well, you know, even under the worst of circumstances, you can be fortunate. And this happened in Montgomery County in the Philadelphia area, which is, as the people who talk with us from the prosecution team, I mean, they were absolutely fabulous, and they are actually still close friends today, all of them. They were extremely helpful. They answered every question. I never felt rushed ever. They were very concerned about our feelings. But on the other hand, they were pursuing a case and making sure everything was buttoned up. But
so charges were brought against the perpetrator. What happened next?
Okay, so he wanted to go to trial. And then we were hearing the possibility of end of March, maybe April, would be a new trial date. And so now facing another trial date, the guy that did it must have really been thinking about, you know, if I want it with a first-degree murder situation, if the jury goes there, I will never get out. I'll come out horizontal, and I'll be dead when I get out of here. But if he took a plea, at least he had some control over his circumstances as they would play out. So it became on the Mitchells to convince the prosecution team, who, by the way, wanted to take it into courtroom. It was up to us then to actually, believe it or not, go in and convince the prosecution team from the district attorney down not to do this. And we did that. What happens is, proving premeditated murder, from everything I knew about what happened that night, I didn't think they had a case. And they never acted like they really did either. But he was charged with that. Premeditated would be like he went there to kill her that night. And third-degree murder was what he was actually pleading to. So in a way, if you went into the courtroom and went through the case, and you managed to get him convicted of third degree, that's great. But that outcome was what he was willing to go for anyway in the plea. So the way I put it with the district attorney and the prosecution team is, you mean to tell me we could win the game without playing it, but you want to go play the game anyway? I mean, you get a victory. So we looked at it like, look, we're not going to get him on first. We can get him on third. He'll get 30 years. One way or another, we talked the prosecution team into going that way, and that's how it went.
I think there's a misconception that once there's a conviction and the perpetrator is behind bars, that there's some sort of closure for the family. Did you find there to be any level of satisfaction, any kind of closure for you, or does the grief move in different directions?
Well, that's a really good question. Seriously, good question. I would say that I felt like the only closure about that day was April 20th of 2006, when he showed up in one van and left at another. He showed up in the county prison van and he left in the state prison van and went to the state prison. But the only closure was, that's all we need to do about him. That was it. Whether there was any sense of fairness, because I mean, how can there be? Your daughter's gone, and even he can't do anything about it. So. But at least there's nothing else to do about him. It's an outcome that he picked. It's an outcome that we said, okay, we approve it. And it's like, okay, you go that way, and we'll get in our car, and we'll go this way. If that adds up to someone thinking that's closure, I guess that was closure. But I felt like we don't have to deal with that anymore. And, you know, now we can think of other things. I mean, you're still sort of figuring out how to pick up the pieces, and I mean, at that point in time, was 10 months after it happened, roughly speaking. I mean, we still didn't have a gravestone up. So yeah, you know, our nightmares were having nightmares.
It was important to Kristen's friends and to you as the family that her story not be forgotten, that people learn something from it, that there be a lesson. What is that lesson, and what is the mission of the foundation that was created to keep Kristen's memory and her story about dating violence alive?
Yes, we wanted to keep the memory that she was even around alive. And I commend her friends for starting something called Kristen's Crusade, which originally was just a run walk, and at St. Joseph's University, where Kristen graduated from. And so we had T-shirts. We had hundreds of people come out, and we did this 5K run walk. It was really nice. It was a beautiful day, and it could have been one or done. You know, it's like nobody really thought this would be an annual thing. And it was just kind of like, let's do this in her memory and her relatives and friends. And so that was in September of 06. And then at the end of 07, after we had our second one, a couple of our very closest friends actually decided we'd like to start a foundation. We'd like the Mitchell family in it. We actually had our prosecutor of the case in it. So we had a really kind of a, almost like an all-star team from the beginning. I mean, we had some of our professors. I mean, these are all people with great talents who most of them knew Kristen, loved Kristen, and wanted to do something. So the mission, simply put, has always been to get the warning signs, to get information out to people as about dating violence, for people to have a good, solid understanding of, if you see these types of behavior taking place for yourself or for your friends, for your family members, if you see these things, you need to do something about it, because if you let it keep going, it will only get worse and only escalate. And if it gets bad enough, somebody can get killed. And that's really been the whole point. And I can tell you, since we've been doing this, and I've been very fortunate to be asked to give speeches about it, as we've been doing this, I'm just so happy about how well it works, how rapt people are when we talk about these subjects. I mean, we're talking with them about their lives. And it's like, if you don't find this interesting, I mean, look, this happens. And there are all kinds of statistics, and I try to really dial it down because they get boring really fast. But when you think about it, for women between the ages of 16 and 34, 25% of them will experience violent behavior in a relationship, usually in that time period. Can happen before that, can happen out of it after that, but typically that's it. Somewhere between 16 and 34, one out of four. And the statistics that I'm hearing nowadays, more and more than that, is actually one in three. And the other part, the other asterisk, is it's not always men hurting women. Sometimes it's women hurting women in what are supposed to be intimate relationships, you know, loving relationships. And the statistic I'm hearing lately is one in four women actually are violent with men the other way. So, you know, the stereotypical thing is some man in a rough neighborhood beating on his wife or his girlfriend or something like that. Some reason you can't understand, she puts up with it and stays with him. That's the old stereotypical tape that everybody plays in their head. The problem is it's really inaccurate, and it can happen to anybody. I mean, I've met so many people over these 11 years. I mean, I have met the most precious, wonderful, smart people, loving people, who will, after a speech, come up and say to me, you know, Mr. Mitchell, I haven't told anybody this before, but I dated a guy for a year and a half. I mean, this could be a ninth grader, little ninth grade, you know, young lady in high school, and saying, this guy really used to hurt me, and I broke up. And until I heard your speech, I didn't even know it was abuse. I mean, I didn't really know what a healthy relationship was. I thought that's just kind of what guys do. So there's a lot of teaching out there, and there's a lot of white space for people to get out to talk about these types of things. And for instance, talk about what the warning signs are, talk about what can happen. And then the other part of it is, like, you know, what happens if it's happening to a friend of yours? I mean, that's something I like to talk about quite a lot too, because most of the things you should do with your friend to get that person out of that relationship, most of the things you think you should do, quite honestly, you really shouldn't do. You actually make it worse, because you want to yell at your friend and you want to judge them and jump up and down. And you want to say, what are you thinking about? And this kind of thing. All you're really doing is accidentally becoming another abusive person in their life, as far as their minds are concerned, because that's, of course, not your intent. So they're dealing with a difficult, let's just use the stereotypical for a minute. They're dealing with a difficult boyfriend. They know some of it feels bad. And now their best friends are yelling at them and saying, well, why are you hanging out with that guy? And then what you actually accidentally do is put them in a position where they feel now they need to defend the guy who's abusing them. And for instance, when parents find out, and I've talked with plenty of parents with young girls who were dating guys who were difficult and manipulative and controlling, I've talked with them. I said, just about anything you think you should do, don't do. You think you should go over to his house and yell at him or challenge him in some ways, or, you know, it will not work. You will just drive these two people closer together, and that guy will isolate you more from your daughter than you can ever imagine, and you don't want that either.
Yeah, what is the right course of action for
parents? Well, I know. It's definitely perplexing, isn't it? So the best course of action is that you want to keep the lines of communication wide open. So let's say I'll make up a story here, but I'm this 16-year-old girl, and this is happening to my friend, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, she's in one of those relationships I've been hearing about. I would say to her, here's what you want to do. If you really want to be that person's friend, and clearly you do, then you need to hang in there. For instance, let me give you a piece of news. This is not about you. It's not about you. It's not about your feelings. It's about your friend, and it's about her feelings. So you don't want to introduce your feelings into this any more than possible, okay? I mean, the only thing you want to introduce in is I care about you. That's about it. I care about you, and I'll never leave you. I will stand by you. You want to try to get some information to your friend. You know, there are brochures. There are websites. There are national numbers you can call. There's one that's 800-799-SAFE, and you can call it. It's 24 hours. It's open. They're counselors. They are not going to send police to somebody's house, you know, just because you called. I mean, it's anonymous. It is open-ended. It's wonderful. And there are domestic violence agencies everywhere. They're local and national. Anyway, you want to get as much information as you can, and you want to be as gentle with your friend as possible. So you want that person, maybe if you have a brochure, you say, look, don't read it now, but read it when you get a chance. And the person doesn't, they push it back and push it back. Say, look, just stick it in your pocket, and on your own sometime, just read it. That person will not get out of that relationship. I don't care if they're 12 or if they're 52 and married. They will not get out of that relationship until they want to get out of that relationship. That is a hard fact. I liken it to, and it's sad to say this, but it really is a pretty accurate thing. It's like dealing with an alcoholic or dealing with somebody who's a drug abuser. They will not get out of it until they want to get out of it. They have to have a firm conviction about, okay, I've had enough. I want to get out of it. And then there's a whole process for getting out of it because, for instance, Kristen Mitchell, my own daughter, she did precisely what you don't want to do. You do not want to be dealing with a manipulative, controlling person and break up all alone in your apartment at 2 or 3 in the morning. It is like completely wrong. I'm sure she felt it was honorable. I think she probably felt like, okay, this is the opportunity to level with him. Because you would think, well, I don't want to do it in a crowded restaurant. You know, what if he gets upset? The fact of the matter is you would want to do it in a crowded restaurant because he probably won't get as upset. And if he does, chances are if anything starts to happen, someone's going to stop it. The best thing I've ever heard was from the prosecutor. And she said, get someone else's phone, call this person up, and make it very clear and very short. You and I are finished. There is no future. Nothing's going to happen. I'm not going to see you again. I'm not going to talk to you again. I want no more text messages. If you send them, I will block you. Basically, chop it off. You have to chop it off. Now, some people feel like the guy might kind of go away. And again, I'm using the male-female, that's stereotypical. But the guy might go away and he's all miserable or whatever happens. And it's like, look, we dated for a year and a half. Can't I see you one more time? I mean, can't I at least formally say goodbye? There are a lot of people buried in various places around the world who saw that guy one more time. I met a woman not that long ago who gave a talk. She is blind in her right eye because she saw him one last time. Because she sat in her car on some parking lot and saw him one last time. And right before he got out of the car is when he pulled his gun out and shot her in the face. And she's very lucky to be alive, but she is blind, one eye. And I mean, he shot her and left her there. And he didn't know that she lived. And that made it easier to get him later, put him away. But no, you know, I mean, it has to be complete cold turkey. That's it. Never again. I mean, the whole thing. That's it. That's it. You know, it's may sound cruel and tough and all that, but I've heard, at this point in my life, I've heard way too many stories.
Did you blame yourself in the days after your daughter's murder? Did you wish you had done more? Did you wish you would ask more questions? I mean, I presume some of that is inevitable.
You know, I do think it is a very common thing for you to search back through the days or in the days leading up to it or whatever. You know, I think all of her friends have done that. I know of several of her teachers. She did see a teacher a few days, and this is in college, a college teacher, one that taught her accounting, who's the guy, this man is now on our board. But Kristen stopped by and was talking with him, and at some point he said, well, you know, what else, what have you got going on after you graduate? He says, well, I'm dating this guy, and kind of talked about him. Yeah, it's kind of difficult at times, but I can take care of it myself, you know. But yeah, you know, it's kind of a pain in the neck and all these things. And so this man did what most of us would do and just figure, well, okay, you know, there are difficult people and you'll figure it out somehow. And he really kicks himself. I mean, he had the opportunity right there to say, well, tell me more about this. And of course, you know, we're all really smart. We all are great Monday morning quarterbacks. We know exactly how to play the game the day after. I don't think my wife and I walk around with a lot of guilt about it. We didn't really know anything about it. I think we're fortunate. I think one of the reasons that our marriages lasted so long is that we don't have any guilt about that, right? Because there's some crazy high statistic about all the marriages that break up when a child is killed or a child dies. I mean, I feel like I heard 75% of marriages with a child that died break up. You know, it's like some way high statistic, you know, much more than, I think what happens for anybody, honestly, Emily, is that when you're around something like this, you're either going to get closer to God or whatever we're here for. You're going to get closer or far away, but with the other one, it's going to be big. You're going to get really close. I know people, on the other hand, who just, like, if they ever went to church, they said, I'm never doing that again. No God would ever allow something like that to happen to my child. I am done. I am done. There is no God. And I'm very fortunate because I'm in the other group. I really do believe that even though we do not understand, we do not have the capacity or the information, that I do believe things happen for a reason, and I feel horrible about what happened to Kristen. But on the other hand, I feel great about what we've managed to do with something that's so horrible, because I've gotten plenty of emails from people who said, I listened to what you said, and I was in a bad relationship, and I got out of it, and I'm so happy now.
Well, so, you've certainly turned this tragedy into an educational experience for people, a consciousness raising, both for young people who are in dating relationships, troubled dating relationships, and their parents, because you send your child off to college and hope for the best and pray for the best for them. And I'm sure it's been enormously helpful to the people who've been able to attend your speeches and to listen to you today. We've been talking to Bill Mitchell, the president of the Kristen Mitchell Foundation. Bill, thank you so much for taking the time and sharing your story.
Yes, thank you for the opportunity, and I just want everybody to be safe. God bless everybody.
Bill Mitchell, president of the Kristen Mitchell Foundation. His daughter Kristen was murdered by her boyfriend just after she graduated from St. Joe's in 2005. Bill travels the country raising awareness of dating violence. The Mitchells have also lobbied for a Maryland law requiring mandatory domestic violence education in middle and high schools. For more information about the foundation or Kristen's Crusade with a K, an annual fundraiser in her honor, visit kristenscrusade.org. Thanks for joining me this morning. You can email the show or browse the archive. Go to morefmphilly.com and click on Tell Me More. For 101.1 More FM, I'm Emily Scheibert.